I'm going to go keep on reading on page 145. Here, where we stop, where we're talking about socialization and the criminal and delinquent gangs, which led us into the discussion of people who leave ISKCON and form these groups. It's a term you don't hear anymore. They used to be called fringies. You don't hear it so much in the United States. Congregation, not a congregation, but because we used to disown these people, we really did. We used to disown them. But actually, it's an accurate term. You know the sociologists, the term they use? Like in subliminal, liminal is something that's borderline, so you say liminal people. That's a sociological term. Anyway. So let's go on the bottom of page 145. He's talking about the formation of delinquent or criminal gangs. Not even the ordinary social group is free from this tendency to rationalize their weakness, rail at that which is beyond their reach. The average or normal man preserves his self-respect not merely by finding a task worthwhile and gaining recognition in contemporary society. He is likely also to have solved the conflicts of his teens by lowering somewhat his conscience threshold. So now he's talking about the normal, well-adjusted person. What's the matter?
Where? 146.
I stopped at the bottom 145, now we turn to 146, right? See, when he analyzes normal congregations in terms of what they, what groups they fall into, it gets divided into different groups. He goes into a small town and figures out who's there. So one group is the faithful. Those are the ones that are actually pursuing their spiritual goals. In this congregation that he studied, it was about 16% was the faithful. But more than half is what he called the complacent. They go to church, they're normal, well-adjusted people, but really, they don't want to get too holy or anything like that, Then there's another group, about 9% he calls the pagan. And then the mentally ill, which is 25%, according to him. This is in a small town in Indiana, somewhere around right after World War II, maybe.
But what are the characteristics of the pagan?
Well, the pagan, he says this is not a good word, but people who've actually given up on... he says in the place that he's talking about, there aren't any delinquent groups, any delinquent gangs or anything. This was a long time ago. But people who are rebellious... Springville's pagans were, for the most part, older persons of the playboy type who had gone their way regardless of community opinion and seemed to be suffering no particular pangs of conscience. The sinful people who are well-adjusted and sinful, openly sinful. They don't care what anybody thinks of them. But here he wants to talk about the normal, the complacent, what he calls here the complacent. The average or normal man preserves his self-respect not only by finding some vocation and gaining recognition in contemporary society, you're a good guy, other people say you're a good guy, somebody. He is also likely to have solved the conflicts of his teens by lowering somewhat his conscience threshold. Household or life, right? His confidence and self-assurance are apt to be tinged by a trace of flippancy or of cynicism. Making light of accepted values, being a little cynical, well, nobody really follows these things. All those people who are in church all the time and they're always praying, they're doing the same thing as me, they're just not talking about it. This kind of thing. you'll see this formation in them. There's this flippancy or cynicism. You know, the Catholic Church is full of priest jokes all the time. He is apt to lay great stress on certain petty virtues or become sectarian or partisan in his loyalties. So these are different techniques, which we'll talk about more in detail when we get into the chart. Petty virtues, a substitution of minor for major virtues, that becomes important. He mentioned somewhere, Boise mentioned visiting a church where the minister was involved in an adulterous relationship. Couldn't, was it in this chapter? Couldn't really preach about the real thing, but he always laid great stress on regular church attendance on Sunday. That to him was the main thing. You know? Or become sectarian or partisan in his loyalties. Or in other words, many people that you mentioned somewhere find it easier to fight for a cause than to actually live up to its principles. And so you substitute crude loyalty for really fulfilling what you're supposed to fulfill. And you become a partisan or a zealot of some kind. So that's why you see in these kind of intense little Christian churches, they tend to splinter and splinter and splinter and splinter and splinter. Sometimes like that.
Well, what about people that will fight for Islam? Like this...
Well, not everyone who will fight for Islam.
You know, he was like fighting for the men or something. You know, tenaciously.
Well, I don't know the man. I can't say.
No, but I know the devotees. They say like he just really likes...
Well, there are people, not everybody that fights for a cause is like that.
But he doesn't really, he's not strict about following the regulations.
Well, that may be, then that's his displacement.
But he...
He probably knows what he should be doing. He can't do that, so as a substitute, I'll do this.
Yeah.
I said that can very well be that a person is not strict, and he accepts those values. He feels in his heart a pang of conscience that I should be like this. He finds it easier to actually become a fight for this cause and come out victorious. This is something I can succeed in.
It's almost the same in Bhagavad Gita. If you can help to be the highest thing
that... No, I'll tell you, I had an encounter with a devotee once who, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. He's just running down basically, but this devotee once, he couldn't follow the principles. And yet he also wanted to have the conviction that he was a great devotee. So he became convinced, this was at a farm community, that all these Brahmins who were following the principles were not really taking care of the cows, and he was the appointed savior of the cows. And he got a donation from somebody to help take care of the cows. And then that became like his big thing, you know. That he was now empowered by Krishna to save the cows because of all the devotees who were strictly following, or somehow or other there was something wrong with him. So people pointed out to him, you know, Krishna liked both the brahmanas and the cows. He liked the cows and ate the brahmanas, you know, but he couldn't hear it. He was completely... it's a whole other story. It's an ongoing case. Did you have did you have your hand up?
Oh, just before. It was about Frank Hiroshi. To mention, he's not a devotee.
Oh, right.
He doesn't identify as a devotee.
He may not. But he still he could be a person that, to that extent, you know. But you will find... But we're talking here about the sectarian or partisan. Sometimes you get fanatics. And when you see fanaticism, watch out. You know? Something's wrong. It's an overcompensation for a lack of faith. And it used to bother me a lot in ISKCON when I'd see a fanatic and everybody say he's a great devotee. But they would never lasted. Anyway, so we're talking about the ordinary man. This is his analysis of ordinary society, where you kind of pay nominal lip service to the standards, but you've really adjusted on a lower level. You haven't formed a separate gang, although you may have a little clique of friends and you say certain jokes in common, but you haven't become a delinquent. You support the established society. His business and his pleasures are not infrequently a means of escape from a sense of inner disharmony which leaves him restless and unsatisfied. That is the sentence about the United States of America. Great, most of the accomplishments of the United States rest in here, huh? Busy, 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 be always on the go, moving, moving, moving. If you have, 5 minutes where there's not something to do here. So restless, hence the intolerance of the crowd, the mob psychology. When you get together as a crowd, you become very intolerant of others and self-righteous in a way that you wouldn't even be by yourself. The man in the street is not likely to regard with complacency that which raises misgivings in regard to his protective devices. In other words, he's found a way to maintain his self-respect. I'm an okay guy. While deep in his heart, he knows he's not living up to the highest standards.
He's proud of somebody who brings it out.
Yeah, so he's got his protective devices. Right. He may be lost in admiration for the kind of superiority which he sees in Babe Ruth or Jack Dempsey or Colonel Lindbergh, baseball player, boxer, and the famous aviator. These are dated references.
Lindbergh actually didn't
flow
in the South Pole.
Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic solo. That
solo,
was his thing.
Solo,
this bird who didn't flow in the South Pole.
I grew up in his hometown.
But Lindbergh is a hero, you know. St. Louis, they still got from the airport, they got his plane up there, the Spirit of St. Louis plane. But the kind of, so people have their heroes that are okay to have. And he may admire them. But the kind of superiority which makes him uncomfortable within is not kindly received. The cross and the hemlock have been meted out not so much to those who have threatened our economic interests as to those who threaten the moral self-respect of men. That is a very heavy sentence.
What's the hemlock?
Socrates. That's the cross is Jesus and the hemlock. Socrates, had to drink hemlock. He was killed by the Athenians. And he said the threat to the society was not economic. So this is the in some ways the superficiality of a Marxist analysis where everything is economics. But rather somebody really threatens your self-respect, your protective devices. People can't stand it. And they'll go so far as to kill people. For this. This tendency is to be observed even in the church, the one among all human institutions in which men meet on their highest levels, which stand for that which is enduring and universal in human society, i.e. code word for God, enduring and universal. Enduring means lasting, eternal, and universal means located everywhere. Yeah, the highest truth, God, Sanatana Dharma. It meets on that. Even here, that is to say, in the church, we see the common tendency to degenerate into ecclesiasticism. That is to say, where loyalty to a particular institution replaces or a substitute for loyalty to God. With the emphasis placed upon protective devices. Now, this is an Old Testament reference, the tithing of mint, anise, and cumin. In other words, tithe means to give a certain portion of your income. So you're very exacting in doing certain things. You become kind of obsessed. You have to do this. You go to certain things. If you just do these rituals, then you're okay. Creedal formulas and ritualistic niceties. And nowhere else, unless it be in certain organizations which make a religion of patriotism, do we find more bitterness when protective devices are challenged. This is like the... This is true precisely because the church is primarily concerned about the problem of safeguarding the moral self-respect of its members. And the reason we want to read this here is ISKCON is not exempt from this tendency. It will, the same thing will be happening to our movement if it isn't already happening to our movement, unless somehow or other you can have an established church that's in a state of perpetual revolution at the same time. See, usually what he's describing is what Krishna calls dharma glani, the decline of religion. So what happens, and Krishna says he has to come again and again because of this dharma glani, something is established by God that in course of time. And then what happens? It's renewed again. Krishna comes, or he sends his servant, he sends his prophet. This is a perfect description of history of religions, not just any religion. It's been around for a long time, goes through this. Somebody comes with a real vision, a real fresh inspiration, things really get compromised. And then somebody comes who really upsets people. Now, talking about people who challenge the moral self-respect of human beings to the point of ready to be assassinated, look at what happened to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. There was a revolutionary, and he came right to this town and took on the Jati Gosais and everybody else. You know, when he did Parikrama, the whole, all of Vrindavan was closed down to him. There are people who are still alive who remember that.
Martin Luther,
people everywhere, but I mean, just the example close to home. Because what had happened to Lord Chaitanya's movement? There had been so many compromises where people were still claiming to be great devotees or advanced devotees, but actually in their practices, they weren't actually strict. They had found various different ways where the weeds that we discuss about, that are discussed about, Patishta, Puja, Kutinata, all these different things that had grown up and were being cultivated. Right? So this can happen. And unless one is perpetually vigilant. You see, the point is that you cannot for a moment think, now we're okay. Now we've established, you know, Krishna conscious the way it's supposed to do, we can relax now. You can't. Not for 2 seconds. But it's going to be inevitable because it's the material world that you're going to have these things happen. But the other thing is, you see, one way that ISKCON, early on we didn't acknowledge our congregation, called them fringies. It was a bad word for them. You know, we pretended they weren't there. And they kept coming and coming. So we stayed pure simply by disowning that group of people. Then it began to occur to us somewhere along the line that we had obligations toward them. As that group began, in some ways it just became bigger and bigger and bigger, I guess. And these were people who weren't following, not all of them, but for the most part had some compromised level of Krishna consciousness. So we thought of ourselves as different from an ordinary Christian church simply because we didn't count those people that they were counting. That was part of what we were doing. But now there are people. I wanted you to read that part of the 12th chapter where Krishna says, surrender to me. If you can't do that, follow the regular principles of Krishna consciousness. If you can't do that, work for me. That means our organization has three groups of people, because Prabhupada explains in the purport. Surrender to me means, you know, be involved in spontaneous devotional service. If you're not spontaneously engaged in devotional service, then follow the regular principles. By regular principles, Prabhupada lists exactly rising early, taking bath, going to Mangalarti. I mean, the whole nine yards, you know. The life of a temple devotee. You don't have to live in the temple, but if you're living outside the temple, if you're performing Vidhi Bhakti, that's what you should be doing at home. If you can do that, then work for me. So then you're still part of our movement. Prabhupada said one should have some sympathy. What was the word he used? One should be sympathetic to the propagation of Krishna consciousness. And you make a contribution. You work for Krishna. By providing, and he mentions four things that he learned from an economics professor. A labor, organization, capital, or property. Management, organization, management.
In the nectar of instruction, under the verse, Dadati Prati Krishna Ti, and he said, he's talking about the exchanges between the books. He said, just like we go to our members and they give us prasadam and we give them books and they consider them.
Yeah, they're part of the movement.
They're devotees.
Because then he said, then Krishna says, then if you can't do that, then, you know, join United Way or the Boy Scouts or somebody else. Right, so those three groups are, that's part of our movement. We can't disown those people.
Which one is the third one?
Huh?
Which one would be the third one? People going out?
No, the three are part of. So then the fourth one is, if you can't do that, then try to become detached from the fruits of your work.
Yeah, well, you said three.
So three is first, spontaneous devotees, regular devotees, and helpers. Or,
But then also there's shades of gray also. I mean,
there are lots of shades of gray.
It's a continuum.
Yeah, it is a continuum. That's right.
Just one Manisha Prabhu said, that he's saying how we go to life members' house, we go to Prashad, I think it was Prashad. In that same purport, he lists all six exchanges by senses and talks about how you should do this with other devotees separately. And then he goes through and he does all six exchanges again, and that you shouldn't engage in with non-devotees. So it would tend to support what you just said, and he was considering these people outside would be our people if we're going to be engaging, exchanging.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This prediction, or at least the view of the history of religion, is that religions generate into a compromised situation. And I remember Sacharya Maharaj discussed this, and Prabhupada referred to that as churchianity.
Churchianity, yeah. He calls it ecclesiasticism, which is the same. The same, this is another way of saying the same thing. Ecclesia is a church.
And Prabhupada's formula for preventing that from happening to ISKCON was the Strong Mind Program, basically.
Yeah.
Which, if we go a little deeper in the analysis, it kind of keeps that revolution alive, at least within ourselves.
Mm-hmm. See, I really think that the Lord Chaitanya's movement has this potential, you know, to keep on going. And to avoid at least wild swings like this, but look what already happened. You know, look what happened in the 500 years. You know, after Lord Chaitanya's immediate people left, then it went down, then it came back up again with people like Baladeva Vijayabhushana, then it went back down again, then with Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Bhakti Siddhanta Prabhupada, back up again. You know. Yeah, and even in ISKCON you can see some troughs and valleys, some peaks and valleys. You know. But you see the thing is, you know, see we already have this tension. On the one hand, if you want to maintain really high standards, then you have a small little group and you can quote, you know, we're selling diamonds, you can't expect everybody to join. You can have a small little tight exclusive group of people that's got really rigorous standards. And with their basic act, you know, where they're very exclusive. That is to say, they exclude others. That's the one polarity. People are afraid that if you, you know, let everybody in, then, you know, you're going to accommodate people. People are very afraid if we're friendly and open to people and welcoming and accepting, you know, then we lower our standards. We're validating improper behavior. And you lose your high standards. So there's these two poles. But see, what we have to do is you have to, and this is where Boysen, to me, is quite good, maintain very high standards, and at the same, you have to learn how to maintain very high standards and at the same time be a human being. I have a saying about ISKCON, you know, that you strive very hard and after many years you become a pure devotee. Then you make even more advancement and you become a human being. Because sometimes people got very strict and very, you know, he's a great devotee, but try to live with a guy for 2 days, you know. Yeah.
Actually, that's what Sanatana Goswami told Radha Shakur in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Maybe some bitches and don't behave nicely, and some don't behave nicely, but bitches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could take it that way, huh? Sure.
So we should just.
But it's hard to do, you see, because it tends to be. To most people, it looks like you've got a kind of manifest a contradiction. But that's okay. That's what we have to do. On the transcendental platform, you can do
it. You said something about Radhadish, which was really stressing. You mentioned how the Amish people expand their movement because they don't take any people from the outside. They give birth to and raise all of the constituents. The Amish are a church in America.
Yeah, let me explain. They're in our region around Gita Nagari. They were like 18th century German group, pietistic German group that migrated to America. And they reject everything modern. They still farm with horses. Our people go to their midwives. They shear our sheep. You can still get old-fashioned farm equipment from them because they keep it going, although they use horses. They're pietistic Germans. They don't even use buttons because they were invented after a certain date. They use hooks and eyes.
But what's the cutoff date?
I forgot what it is. Whenever their founder was there. So they dress in black, and I don't think they're going to last. It's a shame. But anyway, because what's happened is the suburbs, it's there in Lancaster County, and they used to be quite isolated, but now the whole area is becoming like suburbs. And I was going out to Gita Nagari on a train once, and I was looking out the window, and going through Lancaster County, and I saw this Amish man plowing his fields behind a horse. He's wearing a complete black, big black hat, a beard. But right along his field, where there hadn't been before, there's a whole line of suburban backyards. In the backyards are swimming pools. Next to the swimming pools are ladies with little bikinis on. How long is this going to happen? You know, the contrast is just too much. And they're doing interesting things with their kids. But anyway, to maintain their purity, you cannot convert. There's one devotee from Gita Nagari who left our movement. He tried to become Amish, and they just wouldn't accept him. He wore the clothes and the beard and everything like that. And because they don't want any polluting influences to come in from the outside. And so they got a self-contained society, and the main thing that they do is called shunning or banning. That when a person becomes worldly or corrupt, he's excommunicated. I mean, the guy's married, his wife doesn't talk to him, his children don't talk to him, he's just like he doesn't exist anymore. That's what they do. There was one guy who finally went to court, and the court, in America said, we don't interfere with this. Because he had gotten banned from the church. And I remember once in Philadelphia, we were out on some preaching program in a college, and there was some poor 18-year-old kid who was an Amish kid who had been kicked out of their society. I never saw a more lost soul in my life. I mean, he was like so old-fashioned in some way. Anyway, this.
So what you were saying in Radhadish was that's
not what we do.
That's not our Bob.
We're always bringing people in. As long as we're preaching, you're going to have those influences coming in. Even if some of us are free of them ourselves, they'll be coming in. What the Amish do with their children, by the way, when the child gets to be about 14, then they can put on blue jeans, drive cars, go to movies and things like that. They're allowed a period of wildness because right now they're side by side. And like they have some, so they have their own school system and everything, although it doesn't go up very far. In the farmers markets, they sell their produce and things they make. To the normal people, and the kids love to go to them, the kids, they see this whole society running around them with rock and roll and drugs and sex and everything. So they have a period of license from about 14, and then when they're 18 or 19, they choose what they want to do. Yeah, either they can leave, and a lot of them become Mennonites, which is a sort of more liberal. They were actually first, and then the Amish were like more strict Mennonites.
The Mennonites have great name of syrup.
Yeah, the Mennonites, I mean, they're also, but they're not so strict. Or else they come in. That's what they found themselves. I'm sure they do that because they had no choice. The kids are going to do this anyway. But that's what happens with the Amish. This is talking about the socialization of young people.
So they're not your kids.
No, there's, and they cheat too. They have their secret electric. See, they don't use any electricity, but Gohari said the guy took them out to his barn once. And he had his, because they eat meat, and so, you know, they really want to have freezers. They have electric line going down the barn under the bales of hay at a freezer. So some of them, anyway, they compromise. Have a deep freezer. Otherwise, you're going to have a problem. So I want to get a little further.
They're nice people, though.
Yeah, they're very nice people. Yeah, you like them. You could live with them. You wouldn't feel too much discomfort. Except you wouldn't be able to speak, you know, 18th century, I don't know, low German or whatever, but high German, actually. Middle.
Oh, they don't speak German.
Yeah, they speak German.
I don't think you did not agree with them. Great on
yeah, they're really nice.
He was just chatting with the guy. Mm-hmm.
They're characterized by men sparing the rod of their children.
Yeah, they're very heavy duty. Let's go on. So now, the last paragraph of this section. It follows, therefore, that even though by socializing inferiorities, serious conflicts may be averted and the personality remain normal, the resulting solution is not necessarily a happy one. Just being well-adjusted for Boyism is not enough. You want to be well-adjusted on the highest platform. So this is where it agrees also with our hopes. It may merely, that is the socialization process, socializing inferiorities, it may merely distribute the strain, or what is worse, pass it along to someone else. The jokes which bring relief and self-satisfaction to one brother may cause nausea to the other. The unsought confidence may threaten another's moral safeguards. The common weakness and need of mutual support may result in rationalizing philosophies and attitudes inimical to social progress. See, about this time, he mentions one kind of person, the delinquent formation, as being a playboy. But, you know, pretty soon there was, some 20, 30 years later, there was a magazine with the Playboy philosophy, right? So this is when we made progress. And even the group which stands for that which is universal and enduring in human society, God, Sanatana Dharma, is itself imperfect, needing constant renewal. So he recognizes this need also. It is therefore to be noted that such renewal comes ever through the prophet. This is the social role, the prophet. Through men of the type of Paul of Tarsus, John Bunyan, George Fox, who have found renewal within through reconciliation with that which represents to them society at its best. So now he talks about this chart. And I don't have to read the... If we look at this chart, and you have it in two places, so you can maybe have this page in front of you while having the double-page version of a chart. So you see, it's got rows and columns. The first four columns apply to everybody. Primary difficulty, controlling desire, degree of awareness, and the reaction mode. These are the way he characterizes what people, both in the hospital and in normal life. They both, this characterizes what's going on with them. Then the last three columns, so these, I told you the horizontal is different degrees of adjustment, and I pointed out that this is, it looks to us like goodness, passion, and ignorance. Going up at the top on the horizontal level and going down at the bottom.
Is it meant to be read across horizontally?
Well, you read it, what we're going to do is the first part we're going to read down, the first three, four rows, and then when you get to the solution, then you have to start reading across.
Oh.
And that's basically the way he does it too. So different levels of...
The column attitude, does that correspond with the previous columns? I mean, not eruptive, but...
Yeah, it does.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, it goes across pretty much. Now, as I said, as you say, there are always shades. So things shade off, and in real life you find mixtures of things in different ways. The first four columns represent the... Okay, the last three columns, the type of solution likely to result from the different reaction modes and the means of solution operative therein. So that's the reaction mode and and then the two said the type of development, there's normal growth, there's gradual and eruptive. So eruptive is what he's talking about going on that he's seen in the mental hospitals. But you see, the same thing applies to both normal growth and also these cases of mental illness. So that's what we're going to do. So notice that the primary difficulty he has there is the sense of personal failure. It is intended to denote the sense of inner disharmony, which extends from the divine discontent, which is a precondition of effort and of growth, to the loss of that which makes life worth living to the individual. So it can be a different things can lead up to it. So very exclusive, the divine discontent or some other loss. The sense of inner disharmony between what actually is and what ought to be. That's what he's talking about. What actually is, that is what, if I'm honest with myself, I know I am. And what I ought to be, the standard I have set for myself, or have accepted, right? So then it can become malignant if there's a sense of isolation and guilt. And he points out here that in many, most cases, it has to do with the unassimilated experience pertaining to the realm of sex. It's certainly the case, it starts off in adolescence and remains the case. So whatever it is, this is what we're dealing with, this sense of personal failure. And I think that's always going to be a fact in our movement. And I've even pointed out that we have to say that this sense of personal failure is not wrong. We have so many songs by Bhaktivinod Thakur, you know, lamenting on and on and on about his sense of personal failure. This is something devotees do. And it has to be there. If you don't have it, then how are you ever going to improve?
Yeah. I've seen it also, some devotees have acknowledged also that a lot of times in the name of humility, devotees get into self-condemnation, and the result isn't auspicious. It's not that they're right. These realizations of the great acharya sound to be very self-deprecating or very self-condemning to us in a certain sense. But what's coupled with that is a deep sense of humility and understanding of their eternal position as a servant of Krishna. So this humility actually has meaning and fosters bhakti. Whereas in a lot of cases in non-devotee karmic patients, you find strikingly similar statements of supposed humility. or even in devotees, you'll find statements like that. But they don't have the corresponding symptom of fostering bhakti. They just tend to make people feel more isolated, and you tend to see people drift away from that.
Sure.
So what's there's not much time, but I'd like for you to discuss that.
I always get asked a similar question when the humility and low self-esteem are two different things. So a devotee should not have low self-esteem. In other words, the thing is to understand is that I am spirit, soul, part and parcel of Krishna, and that I am infinitely valuable to Krishna. Now, the fact that I have a fallen condition, I have to look as really belonging to the not-self. So, you know, it's like when you see a child. We are told that when a child has done something wrong, if you say, bad boy, that's not the right... But you say, how can a good boy like... How did a good boy like you do something bad like this? Or that was a bad thing you did. See, the one goes to his sense of self-identity, bad boy, and leads to low self-esteem, condemnation, and everything. But the other, you talk about the person's behavior, and you don't talk about his essence. So our essence, our swarup, is we're servant of Krishna. So anyone who thinks that I'm not a devotee is not actually thinking about his real identity. I may be a devotee and I have to acknowledge that I got this problem, that problem, another problem, but I still remain a devotee.
Or a servant.
Huh?
Or a servant. Read that into my poem. Your devotee is calling, Isn't that in the Nectar of Transcendental Diary? Prabhupada said, no, you shouldn't say devotee, you said your servant is calling. He said, we're constitutionally servant, but we're not always devotees.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. We're constituted as servant. Krishnitya Krishna Das.
What if I was to put forward that for a devotee who had attained that, for an aspiring devotee who had attained that level of realization, he can feel servant Krishna, that it might not be beneficial, it might come in a category of limitation to have this mood, let's say, of Bhakti Yoga Thakur, to try and ascribe that to himself. But that's the type of mood that develops after one actually realizes the true position. And if you get into those feelings before you realize that, it's going to result in low self-esteem or self-condemnation. How do you respond to that?
I don't know. You have to look at an individual case of what people are doing. You know, but the fact is that ultimately you won't make progress. You have to be frank and honest. And the thing is that for people to be frank and honest, they have to have supportive relationships where they can be accepted and valued no matter what. It's just like, you know, the way a parent values a child. Of course, that's on the bodily platform. But still, there's a child will feel, can be understood that, you know, no matter what I do, my parents are still going to love me. They may hate what I'm doing, but they still love me. So one should have that feeling in relationship with God. That will be possible to have that if you feel somehow valued by other devotees. If you don't feel valued by other devotees, then certainly these kind of feelings of humility may actually turn into some kind of malignant thing and not be humility at all. But see, low self-esteem is another form of false ego. Low self-esteem means